is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to The Big Picture, everyone, for this week. And if you have listened to this program over the past 5 years, you know that this show has been a big proponent of dividend-paying stocks. If you've invested in high-quality dividend stocks, you've done well. Dividend stocks have done well during this bull market. Your dividends have gone up each year. And depending on what dividend stocks you actually bought, your dividend yield has been much higher than what you would have received in a bond fund, unless you own junk bonds. So this brings us to the question, does investing in dividend-paying stocks still make sense in this wobbly stock market? And Jim, is this going to be a strategy that's going to hold with us for a while?
You know, I still do, John, but a lot of caveats I'm going to add. There is some risk to dividend-paying stocks depending on where you're investing today. I mean, we've seen many companies over the last 12 months cut their dividends, especially most of it has taken place in the energy sector. But let me just give you a good example, and this is why investors need to be aware of when they're buying dividend-paying stocks, know what they're buying. A lot of this has taken place in energy and shipping, but this will be a good sample of what has happened. TK Shipping, the dividend cut by 90%. EV Energy, dividend cut by 85%. Anadarko Petroleum, dividend cut by almost 82%. Bristol Group, dividend cut by almost 80%. Kinder Morgan, the pipeline company, well known for increasing dividends over the year, they finally decreased that dividend this year by almost 76%. So there are risks to dividend-paying stocks, as I just illustrated. So it's not as easy as it was, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago when we began talking about this.
All right. Well, I know energy stocks, and that's all the way from oil to coal to pipeline companies, have been really hit hard with the drop in oil and gas prices. So why the change in your view on dividends?
I mean, I still believe in dividend paying stocks, and it's the only kind of stocks that, quite honestly, I own. I mean, if I don't receive a dividend, I don't own a stock. However, John, we're probably coming to the end of a business cycle. In our opinion, we think the business cycle has peaked, and we're now entering into phase 4 just before you head into a recession. So along with a peak in the business cycle has also come a peak in profits. So sometime in the next 2 years, in our opinion, we believe there's a very high probability, probably greater than 60%, that the U.S. economy is going to enter into a recession. Now, what happens? As the economy peaks, which we think it has, so have profits at most companies. And it is looking like corporate profits were down roughly 30% Q over Q in Q4. So now a lot of people are going to say, well, I know that's a lot of that has to do with energy. And there was also major charges for an oil spill. So there were some settlements there. But if you back that out, profits were still down 11% in year over year. Profits are down 7%. So this goes back to our theory that we think that we're entering into the final phase of this business expansion. So if the economy slows down, what goes along with that? Lower sales, profit margins are being compressed due to, let's say, anemic productivity. We're seeing slowing GDP alongside a tightening labor market. And what that's going to do is going to put further squeeze on profit margins. So if you look at, let's say, labor market and declining profit margins, it's signaling the risk are rising of another recession. Profit margins are still falling, even though we expect to see that take place even in the first quarter, judging by what companies were saying when they reported their fourth quarter profits. So there could be another 8 to 10% drop in profits. And in the past, historically, when you see profit margins drop by 8 to 10%, they've almost always predicted a recession. If we look at past records where this has taken place. So, John, we're seeing it in the economic numbers. We're seeing it reflected in company earnings. What you haven't seen yet is a drop, let's say, in employment or a rise in the unemployment rate, but we think that's ahead of us.
Well, I know the economic numbers really haven't been that great, and I'm talking about both here and abroad, but the unemployment rate is low. I mean, even though job growth has really been slowing. So how does a lower employment report jive with what we see as growing recession risks?
Well, I mean, if you think about the end of a business cycle, towards the end of a business expansion, companies are, you know, building up inventory, they've made some investments, and so they're hiring. So employment is really a lagging indicator. And the unemployment rate is, if you look at the squeeze or a sequence of economic events, as the economy begins to slow down, that is followed by profit margins declining. And what do companies do? They start taking steps to protect those profits. I mean, obviously, if your sales are down, your profits are down, you know, they start cutting back on expenditures. We saw that take place in the energy industry, where the number of drill rigs, the bidding for new leases, and a lot of CapEx spending was drastically cut. So what companies do, they cut capital expenditures, and then the next thing they do is they begin to cut payrolls. So I would be watching what's going to happen with the job growth figures to see if they slow down as we move forward. And eventually, I think you're going to begin to see the unemployment rate begin to rise again.
Okay, Jim, what would cause you to change that view? I mean, and how does this matter if you're invested in dividend paying stocks?
I mean, if the Fed was to go on pause and basically stop all of its rhetoric about tightening, that would do a couple things. It would allow the dollar to fall, which would help overseas markets, and it would also take pressure off profits of U.S. companies as well. And it would also, you know, think about the manufacturing sector, which many believe right now, if you take a look at the ISM and industrial production numbers, the manufacturing sector is already in a recession. But this would, in my opinion, only delay the next recession. So instead of maybe taking place in 2 years, maybe it takes place in 3 years. So those are the kind of things that maybe would change my mind whether we're heading into a recession next year. I don't expect it this year, unless the Fed continues with the policy mistake and they keep talking about a lot of the rhetoric. But I mean, given what we heard last week on Capitol Hill when the subject matter of negative interest rates were brought up, Sweden has gone to negative interest rates, Japan, Europe, pretty much the developed world is experiencing negative interest rates. The last one standing right now is the U.S. So if that was to change, that would certainly alter the picture in the short run.
All right. Well, right now I hear what you're saying, that the risks of a recession are increasing, which also puts increasing risk on dividend paying stocks, which already happened in the energy sector. So let's get into how investors can actually protect themselves against a reduction or elimination of a dividend, because you still believe in dividend paying stocks.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let me begin by sort of restating my case for dividend stocks before we get into analyzing, let's say, a company to make sure your dividend is secure. I mean, there are two major reasons for investing. One is to produce income, and one is to produce, let's say, growth or an increase in wealth. Now, if you look at the stock market, when you're talking to advisors or you hear somebody quote, well, over the long run, stocks have returned 10%. Well, a good majority, a good 40% of that return has come from dividends. And another factor is in bear markets, you know, higher paying dividend stocks like utilities, consumer staples tend to hold up much better in a market downturn, or as we've seen here quite a bit, in a sideways market. So the nice thing about receiving a dividend, you don't have to wait for the stock to go up to get your return. You're getting paid in actual cash. And the other thing too about dividends is they can increase over time. And let me throw out another factor. If you take a look at the current tax laws, dividends are taxed at 15 to 20%, depending on your level of income, versus, let's say, interest, which could be taxed at 39.6%. So a stable paying dividend stock, number one, they decline less in market downturns than, let's say, a non-dividend paying stock. And when you own a high quality dividend stock, those dividends can increase over time, even during recessions or in a financial crisis. So that's the important thing. A lot of times people get fearful of stocks because they think, oh my goodness, stock market's going down, I'm going to lose my money. Well, I mean, you're going to lose market value of what you own, but that doesn't change the dividends that you are receiving. And I'll give a case here shortly that even in a market downturn, a high quality company, especially the dividend aristocrats, have a habit and a track record of increasing dividends even during a market downturn or when the economy is in the midst of a recession.
Okay, I'd like to get into the weeds and talk about what to be on the lookout for when you are examining dividend-paying stocks, pitfalls, other things that I should know about.
Well, I mean, there are basically three questions every investor should ask before investing in a dividend-paying stock. Number one, does the company have a track record of producing steadily rising profits? I mean, because that's basically what backs the dividends. If a company's not making a profit, they can't pay a dividend. Number two, does it have a track record of steadily rising dividends that goes along with rising cash flows and rising profits? And three, does it generate enough cash to pay those dividends? And I think that's really important because this goes back to Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor. One of the key things that Ben Graham looked at when he was looking at a stock is the company would have had to increase its profits 7 out of 10 years because that shows consistency of a business. And when you're investing in stocks, you're taking a little bit of a risk. And so you want to see that consistency of profits. You don't want a company that's earnings up 20% 1 year, up 30% the next, and then the following year they lose money, and they lose money the year after that. So what you're looking for is consistency. The second thing is if there's consistency of earnings, then you're going to see consistency of dividend increases because that's what you're looking for. I mean, when you invest in a stock, and especially if you're investing for dividends, what you're really looking for is you want those dividends to go up over time. Because if they didn't, let's say the company just is not doing that well financially, they're paying out the bulk of what they earn and they can barely maintain that. I mean, you might as well be in a bond, which is much more predictable and safer. So the reason you want to go into a dividend paying stock is you hope over a period of time those dividends are going to increase, and especially if they increase every year. And then the other thing is you always want to make sure that a company has enough cash flow that's coming in that, number one, that's where the dividends are paid for. They're paid from cash. Earnings, the way we account for accrual accounting, you can have earnings sometimes that are much, much higher than cash flow. That's why we spend a lot of time looking at free cash flow or the cash flow of the company because, folks, you're receiving a dividend. That's where that dividend comes from. So those are three key things that you want to make sure. A consistent track record of earnings, a consistent track record of steadily raising those dividends, and a consistent rise in the cash flow. In fact, when you take a look at going back to the beginning of the last decade, when we had all of the accounting scandals from the Enrons to the WorldComs, one of the problems that is a sort of an alert to an investor is if accruals, in other words, accounting profits are rising much faster than cash flow. That's usually a little red flag that there's something going on, that the company's manipulating or doing something with earnings that just isn't quite right. And that's a heads up and a warning that there could be some hanky-panky going on with the numbers at the company. But John, those three things are really important.
Okay, and it makes sense that a company needs to make a profit and also have the cash to pay the dividends. So those are the three really important things. Any other additional items?
You want to see a steady track record of rising dividends. Usually, you know, just as Ben Graham had a sort of a criteria that he'd like to see earnings rise 7 out of a 10-year period. I prefer things like the dividend aristocrats, but our minimum is dividends must have had increased, let's say, every year for a 10-year period. Even better are the dividend aristocrats. These are companies that have increased their dividends over a 25-year period. And the reason that is even better because that in a 25-year period, you're going to cover probably several business cycles, several recessions, as well as expansions. And if you're raising your dividend during economic downturns, like we saw in 2007 to 2009, or from, let's say, 2000 to 2002, that tells you a lot about the company that you're investing in. The only reason you want to own a dividend-paying stock is you want those dividends to increase every year. Otherwise, as I mentioned earlier, you'd be better off in owning a bond. So I look at dividends as a major wealth-building asset, and more important, especially for those that are heading into retirement, a great, great inflation hedge.
So I know you also use dividend paying stocks in retirement plans as an inflation hedge. So there must be some risks that you see to dividends. We began this big picture segment with a list of companies who've actually cut their dividends. So how do you tell what's going to happen in that area?
Well, I mean, one sign a company may be heading for trouble is an unusually high dividend yield. I mean, you know, if you're screening for dividends, if you have a software program, maybe you're looking in the paper and you see, wow, that is really a high dividend. That could be your first clue. The dividend may be cut. Several companies we mentioned at the beginning of this big picture, like Kinder Morgan, they saw a big spike in dividends. Part of that came from the stock price falling, which means the dividend yield went up. But it was basically a lot of analysts in the market saying, you know what, we don't think this dividend is secure. And in the end, that's exactly what happened. They cut the dividend by 76% in the case of Kinder Morgan. So whenever you see high single-digit yields on a stock, be a little bit wary of the high yield, especially in companies that are usually in sectors that don't pay high dividends, or if they do, the yields are way above the norms of, let's say, the general companies in that particular sector. So one of your first warning signs, John, is the dividend yield is much, much higher than normal for the stock. In other words, a sudden spike in dividend yield as a result of the stock price falling. That means somebody knows something. Somebody, an analyst, a hedge fund, or somebody's looking at that company. It could be even insider selling, but it's telling you there's something amiss there and you need to look a little further.
Okay, supposing I'm an investor and I see a high yield. I mean, do I walk away and look elsewhere?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's all relative to the stock itself and the industry. I mean, there are companies that have taken a hit due to a falling stock market, which they raise their dividend, which, you know, falling. Let me give you an example. Let's just make this easy. Let's say a company pays $1 a share in dividends and the stock is selling at $10. The dividend yield would be 10%. Now, what happens if that stock fell from $10 a share down to $5 a share and is still paying the dollar dividend? The dividend yield would jump to 20%. People love to find something paying 20%, but I'm illustrating the point. A lot of times that dividend yield is going to go up because we're in a downward stock market. We're in a bear market. I mean, think back to what happened in 2007 and 2009 when the S&P 500 lost 45%. And this happened to a lot of high quality dividend paying stocks during the bear market we experienced during that 2-year period. And let me give you an example, one we use often on the program, but a stock like Coca-Cola lost a third of its market value. And the result was that raised the dividend yield on Coke from 2008 to, let's say, March of 2009, when the market bottomed. Coke stock fell from $32 a share to a low of $19 a share by March of 2009. But in 2008, Coke raised its dividend 8%. In 2009, they raised their dividend again. So at the low point, when Coke was selling at $19 a share in March of 2009, the dividend yield was 4% compared to the average dividend yield of Coca-Cola over the last decade, which has been around 2.8%. So Coke's dividend, due to a falling stock price, rose to 4%. So it was a great buying opportunity to pick up Coke, which has more than doubled from its low point in March of 2009. So just because the dividend is higher than usual, it probably has a lot to do with what's going on with the stock market in general.
Okay, so just because the dividend yield has risen really doesn't mean you should necessarily avoid the stock, but that really asks the question then, how can an investor know that the dividend is safe? There must be some other indicators.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, you want to start with earnings per share. So, you know, if a company is paying out 50 cents a share in dividends, you obviously want to see earnings that are above 50 cents. You'd want to see dividends, earnings of maybe $1 a share. So you always want to look at earnings, and you want to look at consistent earnings. You want to see those earnings rise for the most part, every year over a 10-year decade. I mean, Ben Graham's criteria was there must have been at least 7 years of rising earnings in a 10-year period, because Graham recognized that in a recession, you know, earnings don't always rise. So he was looking for consistency. So you begin with earnings per share. Then you want to take a look at the dividend coverage. In other words, you take the earnings and divide it by the dividend to make sure that the dividend is covered by what the company is earning. You don't want to see a company paying out, let's say, $1 a share, and it's only earning 50 cents a share. So you want to make sure that the dividend is covered. And then the other thing that you want is a margin of safety when it comes to dividends. So let's say a company earns $1 a share. You don't want a company paying out more than 50 to 60% of its dividends. Sometimes maybe in an economic downturn, that number may rise a little bit due to, let's say, a pullback or a flattening of earnings, that which you would expect during a recession. But what you don't want is a company that's paying out 90, 95% of its earnings. A very high payout ratio is a signal that there could be something wrong. The other factor that you want to look at in the industry, we call it gearing, and that's really what you're doing, is you're looking for companies that are not highly leveraged, because leverage is a two-edged sword. And when I'm talking about leverage, I'm talking about debt. You have a company that takes on a lot of debt, and this is one of the problems that you've seen in the energy sector. A lot of these smaller companies were borrowing money in the open market to finance their leases and drilling activity. And unfortunately, when the industry turned around and prices dropped, they still had those debt payments, which got a lot of these companies into trouble. If they do have debt, you want to make sure that the company has enough interest or income and cash flow to make those debt payments. Because remember, you are a stock investor. The company also has bond investors. And when the company gets in trouble, bond investors take priority over dividend investors. A company will cut its dividend first before they miss payments on their bonds. So you want to take a look at the interest coverage to make sure that the debt is covered. And then finally, we look at something called free cash flow. And that's just basically the cash the company has on hand after paying all the expenses of the business, paying out their dividend, reinvesting in the business to replace worn out plant and equipment, expenditures for, let's say, research and development. All those things are paid for. It's the money that's left over, and it's out of that money which really determines the cash flow, the increases in dividends. And so, John, those are basically six items that you really want to look at when you're, especially now that the business cycle has peaked. So you need to do a thorough analysis of what you own, or for that matter, what you're considering buying. It will protect you, but also help you gain understanding of the company that you're investing in. Because remember, it's your money. And just as if you were going to go out and buy a car, you would take it out for a test drive, take it out for a spin. You'd want to get a feel for it and understand what it is you're buying. It's the same thing with investing. I'm always amazed at the way sometimes investors casually make investment decisions without thoroughly analyzing the investments that they're making.
You know, we were talking earlier about the risk to dividends in the energy sector. Are there any other industries at risk, as you would see it, if you believe we're heading into a recession, probably next year?
I mean, right now, the primary risk to dividends is in the natural resource sector. I don't care if you're looking at oil and gas, coal, the mining sector. All these companies are in a survival mode right now, and even some of the big companies. I don't care if you're looking at Exxon and Chevron. They've slashed CapEx expenditures. Some of the big companies like Chevron and others, they're laying off employees. But if we head into a recession, as I believe we are in the next 2 years, then you could be looking at industrial companies and financial stocks could be at risk. And a classic example of this is automobile companies. They get stuck with high fixed costs such as labor, and they can burn through cash rather quickly during an economic downturn. The first casualty is usually the dividend. For example, Ford cut its dividend in 2006. They eliminated it in 2007 and did not reinstate that dividend until 2012. Same thing happened with General Motors. So industrial stocks could be at risk in an economic downturn.
Well, this raises the next question then. If those are the industries that are at risk, there must be best industries to find high quality dividends with pretty much a track record of increasing dividends over time.
I mean, you know, these are what we call Warren Buffett type companies. They're companies like consumer staples, healthcare, pharmaceutical companies, food, tobacco, utilities, household goods, companies that produce a service or a product that people need and use every day. I mean, if you're taking a prescription drug because it keeps you healthy, keeps your cholesterol, blood pressure, whatever it is that it does to make you better, you're going to take that. Same thing with food. Men get up every morning and they shave, so they're using Gillette razor blades. So these are the kind of things the companies that either provide a service or do something that is not subject to the vagaries of the economy. And companies, more importantly, that have what we call an economic moat or a franchise that protect the business and its profit margins, because it's the business, the predictability of that business, the cash flow and the return on equity, that all goes into factoring in what the dividend payout's going to be, whether they're going to increase that dividend. All of those things need to be looked at, John, before you delve into getting into dividend stocks. A little bit more complicated, but folks, this is no more complicated than if you were buying an individual bond. I mean, we do the same kind of analysis when we buy an individual bond. Credit analysis, interest coverage, all those kind of things that bear on the financial well-being of the company, because you really want to buy something that's rock solid, because that's what's going to determine whether your interest payment is safe or your dividends are safe, or more importantly, when you're investing with, let's say for dividends, whether that dividend is going to increase over time.
So if we sum it all up here, as far as dividend paying stocks, we still like dividend paying stocks, but unlike the last 5 years, there are greater risks to certain dividend paying stocks, given a looming recession on the horizon. So when investing, do your homework, know what you own and what you are buying. There is more to the story of dividends than just a high yield. But dividend-paying stocks should be a part of every investor's portfolio. So do your homework before you buy, and you might be richly rewarded in discovering some real bargains out there. We'll be back with this in just a moment as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Alec Ross. He is the Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He is a Senior Advisor for Innovation to the Secretary of State, and he's here today to speak with us about his new book, The Industries of the Future, which is actually top 10. It's number 6, I believe, currently on Amazon, and doing quite well for great reasons. Alec, tell us a little bit about your background first before we get into your book, because it's obvious that you have interviewed and talked to a wide range of experts across the globe, and you've seen firsthand the industries that you see shaping the future.
Sure. So my background, look, there isn't an ounce of blue blood in this body. I grew up a public school kid in West Virginia who put himself through college working as a midnight janitor and on a beer truck. From that, I became an inner city school teacher. And I was an inner city school teacher in the 1990s when, like everybody, I was witnessing this technology-led transformation of the economy and of the way that people transacted business. I was also watching the loss of America's industrial and manufacturing base. So I started a company in a basement in 2000. It was just me and three buddies. Didn't have two nickels to rub together. And we started the company, in essence, to try to expand the number of people who were competitive in the digital world. That went really well. You know, and so I did that for a number of years before doing a 4-year stint in government as a senior advisor for innovation to the Secretary of State. And I'm now working as an advisor to investors and corporations, but my day job is as a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University, which is my home, writing this book, The Industries of the Future, which I'm so pleased to talk to you about today.
I I bet you will not be surprised if I tell you the U.S. is right in the middle of a presidential election campaign season, albeit we haven't gotten through all the primaries, so we don't know who the prime candidates are for president for either the Republicans or the Democrats. Here on the program, we have referred to it for years as being silly season, a time when our politicians are kissing babies, although I think the Pope does a far better job kissing babies than they do, and also handing out lollipops and promising better times to voters and lots of free stuff if you elect them. But the outcome of this political election has far-reaching consequences for the U.S. and for the rest of the world, as a matter of fact, when you realize that the dollar is the world's reserve currency out there, the currency of last resort. There are two opposing views being offered to the electorate. One view being presented is government needs to get bigger, offer more benefits, and raise taxes on those who create wealth to pay for bigger government. It is a view that is popular, particularly among young Americans and on college campuses. The other view is that we need to rebuild the economy, energize the private sector, and create more economic growth and reduce regulatory and tax burdens on Americans, and especially on American businesses, notably middle-class small businesses, which do the bulk of the hiring in this country. 90% of the jobs are created by small businesses. So there's a lot at stake right now in this election. There are competing worldviews. They can't really coexist very well side by side. And it also has major implications for financial markets, both here and abroad.
You know, John, I can't think of in probably, gosh, my adult life, an election as strange as this one. I mean, in previous election cycles, there were two or three leading candidates. I mean, you know, think about it. What do we have? I forget. Was it 16 or 17 individuals that entered the presidential side on the Republican Party? It was either 16 or 17. But I mean, it was double digits. But I can't think of a presidential election in probably decades that is as important to the future of the country, the economy, and the markets as this year's election. And especially last weekend with the passing of Justice Scalia, all three, John, if you think about it, all three branches of government are up for grabs. And this will be one of the most pivotal elections in American history, in my opinion. On this show, we have always emphasized that there are three aspects when you're thinking about investing. There's always the fundamentals. There's the technicals. What are the charts saying? And then there are what we call the politicals. Because what happens in the political sphere here or abroad impacts markets, whether it's the Fed making a decision, whether the government is making certain fiscal policy, whether it's tax cuts or tax hikes, or it's bailouts, as we saw during the financial crisis, or negative interest rates, as we're seeing in Europe and Japan today. So all of this impacts the markets, and it's a subject we're going to delve into later on in this segment.
Well, if you examine the issues that are of most concern to Americans, the top two are the economy and terrorism. There are other issues, obviously, but those two comprise the major concerns of most Americans. If you want to know the outcome of this fall's election, listen less to the candidates and pay more attention to the economy over the coming months. In predicting whether the incumbent party can hold the White House, political scientists say two gauges rise above all the others, the president's approval rating and the economic growth trend in the economy the first half of this year. So what does the economic trend indicator series tell you? Because the president's approval ratings have been sliding.
You know, on the surface, things look good. I mean, let's take a look at it from the consumer point of view. Gasoline prices are cheap. The housing market is steadily recovering and is still going up. I think, what was it last year? Housing prices went up 4 or 5%. Job growth has been improving. The unemployment rate has fallen in half. If you take a look at where we were, a little over 10% at the bottom of the recession, we're under 5% now. But part of this, John, is because the job participation rate has been falling as well. The problem that we have in the economy, and this is being expressed why a lot of people have anxiety, is wage growth has been very stagnant, and the economy has not been creating a lot of high-paying jobs. So there are a lot of millennials out there who are out of work, and saddled with high student loans who are attracted to, let's say, Bernie Sanders' pitch of a free education. But overall, we see weakening economic trends in the economy. We'll talk about that in the next segment. And also, in our view, the business cycle has peaked, and we're in the final phase of that cycle before the next recession. So given all of that, that is going to be weighing on voters because, let's face it, when you walk into that voting booth on November, pocketbook issues have always dominated and been at the top, except for now we have terrorism right up there because we almost have terrorist attacks in this country now, small or big, almost on a monthly basis. And of course, we've seen some horrific events take place overseas, for example, and what happened, the tragedy in Paris. So all of a sudden, security, given the mess in American foreign policy, is also high on the list. So it's not just economic issues this year. The top two issues are the economy and security.
And what's interesting, Jim, is when you look at a lot of this and go back through presidential elections, a lot of these trends of which we speak are cyclical. Now, terrorism is obviously different, but market trends, and yet it's the administration that's almost held always responsible for what happens. I mean, we know that a bear market in stocks and a recession swept President Barack Obama into office. So what are the chances of a recession this year prior to the election?
You know, the odds of a recession are increasing, John. We've seen that with recession indicators. They're now over 20%, almost 30%. I really don't believe we're going to see a recession this year. Our best guess, it'll probably hit next year. But that doesn't matter. Statistics show a slowing economy can be just as impactful on a presidential election as one that is in recession. So you don't need to be in a recession for that to have a major impact. The unfortunate thing is not only has the economy peaked, but profits has peaked as well. Year over year, they're down about 8%. Now, in the past, this has always been a prelude to a recession because what happens when profits peak? Companies eventually stop hiring and eventually they start layoffs. A good example is what we're seeing in the energy industry today where the drop in prices has really hurt a lot of capital expenditures. That's caused a pullback in the energy sector. In fact, one of the main reasons earnings are down year over year is the impact of the energy sector on earnings. But what have you seen in the energy sector? They've had massive layoffs. Literally, a couple hundred thousand jobs have been lost in this high-paying sector. But the odds of a recession are increasing as the Fed presses its case for higher interest rates. So, but looking at the fundamentals, the odds of a recession, John, are probably 60% in the next 2 years, 80% in the next 3 years. At least the view of our firm is a likely recession probably next year, not this year, but a weakening economy does not bode well for the incumbent party heading into the fall, which is why we have been getting a lot more defensive since last November.
Well, remember we talked about that the last election cycle, and what we said is typically when things get a little wild in a country like they did after the recession in 2008, voters start throwing out one group of rascals and putting another group of rascals in, hoping that they get change. And that's a historic pattern, so we shouldn't be surprised about it. But as we get closer to summer, we're going to know much more clearly what the election is going to look like. We'll know specifically who the opposing Democratic and Republican candidates will be. And at that time, the issues which will have gelled much more in those candidates' minds and in the public's minds as to where the sides stand. So that will bring greater clarity for the voters at that point. If there can ever be clarity, I mean, can you ever have clarity in political areas?
No, you really can. But let's say we head into the summer and we've got now two candidates. What those two candidates will then try to do is move to the center, because that's where you get the most votes. And then they're also going to clarify what their programs. If you elect me, this is what I intend to do. And you heard that from Barack Obama, and he's followed through. He pushed through against a lot of wishes, Obamacare, which is falling apart now with a lot of companies, basically healthcare companies, losing tens of millions of dollars and backing away from the exchanges. But I'd like to frame this election from a different perspective. And that is, what are the budget realities that will face the next American president? Because in 2001, the U.S. government had $5 trillion in debt. George W. Bush doubled that debt to $10 trillion at the end of his second term. Barack Obama inherited $10 trillion in debt, and when he leaves office next January, his successor will be saddled with $20 trillion in debt. So you think about that for a moment, John. The last two American presidents have doubled the national debt. George Bush doubled it from 5 to 10, and Barack Obama will double it from 10 to 20. And at $20 trillion, that is getting to be a big number. So the next president will take office with spending outpacing revenue, but with ranges that have been, at least at this point, typical over what we've seen over the last 50 years. Now, government revenues have been climbing, which is what they do in an economic recovery. But if we head into a recession next year, what happens during a recession? Revenues will fall, expenses will rise because of unemployment and transfer payments, and we could be looking, John, right back at trillion-dollar deficits again. I mean, this year, they busted the budget deal that was put together in November, busted the budget caps. The deficit was getting down to about $400 billion. This year, it's going to be over $600 billion. They're basically front-loading the economy this year because I think the guys in Congress know that the economy is sort of maturing and heading towards the end of a business cycle. So they lifted the spending caps, and that was both parties going along with that. So the budget deficit this year will be over $600 billion. You go into recession, and we very well could be looking at trillion-dollar deficits because currently total government debt is equal to 100% of GDP.
Is there a point where this becomes unsustainable? I mean, you notice that when you get into these end time situations, meaning end time of a currency, things tend to go up logarithmically. They don't proceed linearly. So it's conceivable, what, in the course of the next presidency, we could double the debt again?
Oh, very much so. And if we go into a recession, we'll be looking at trillion-dollar deficits, just as Barack Obama was looking at trillion-dollar deficits because we were in a recession and a financial crisis. The point is, with the doubling the national debt, how much leeway is there really for the next president to maneuver with? It seems like there is very, very little wiggle room, and we look at budgets rather closely. And that's why it's really important, and let me just throw some cold water onto all these promises of free education and free health care. If we take a look at the government's fiscal budget for 2016, and also taking a look at the government's budget for 2015, the government's fiscal year ended in September. So we're already 5 months into the new fiscal year. 25% of the government's budget will go to Social Security and pensions. 28% will go to health care, such as Medicare and Medicaid. 21% goes for defense spending, and 6% goes to interest on the debt, and welfare is doubled. Welfare spending is now gone up or doubled to 10%. So, John, if you take welfare, Social Security, Medicare, defense, and interest on the debt, you're talking about 90% the government's budget is already spoken for. That leaves, if you take a look at where the government spends the rest of its money, to run the government takes about 1% of its budget. Protection of the country is 1%. Transportation is 2%. And other government spending is 2%. So all of this stuff about all these new programs that candidates are going to give voters, free college, free this, free that, whatever they're talking about free, if you look at where the government spends the money, 90% of this budget is already spoken for, leaving only 10% to work with. And what are you going to do? You're going to cut the Department of Justice? Are you going to cut congressional salaries? So any new programs like free medical or college would have to come from somewhere, because Social Security, Medicare, and welfare and interest for the debt, not counting defense, is 70%. And with security issues, the second top priority with voters, do you think voters want to say, hey, we're cutting back on security, which we're actually the Obama administration is doing right now? So there's very little room for anything else. And that's the reality that we find ourselves in an election year when they're, you know, kissing babies and handing out lollipops and talking about all this free stuff. And the tragedy is the media is not covering this. They're not picking up on this. They're talking about irrelevant issues. And a lot of people are buying into the fact that they can get a lot of free stuff if only we can make somebody else pay for it.
Well, I think the reason for that is because when you talk about $20 trillion, it's not that it's not a realistic number. It doesn't seem like a real number to people. They can't digest what that means in terms of them. And they don't realize the impact of these large debts and how they're actually impacting, first of all, their own lives, and more so that which is going to be the lives of their children and grandchildren. There are five major areas that high national debt impact. Number one, there's a higher cost of living. The cost of credit is much higher. Two, there's slower wage growth. You know, Senator Sanders is always talking about the disparity between the rich and the poor. This is one of the reasons for it. The dollars are not being invested. They're going to government rather than being invested in growth projects and in jobs, etc. Number three, it results in generational inequality because the World War II generation and then the baby boomers and some of the Gen Xers behind them are tailing out with significant amount of wealth, while the lower generations have much higher debt burdens for these kids that they have to lug along with themselves. And it's only going to get worse as the application for more and more Medicare and Social Security benefits increases. Number four, there's reduced fiscal flexibility. They can't afford another recession because they just don't have the flexibility to try to re-stimulate their way out of it, which, by the way, Jim, is why, say, for example, Chair Janet Yellen has been suggesting rather loudly to the Congress every time she's there, could you guys please provide some stimulus for us? You know, you're getting in sort of a couch language like, don't you think you'd want to do this yourselves? And finally, it results in a series of fiscal crises down into the final crisis, because unchecked borrowing leads to a fiscal crisis such as we've seen in Greece, in Argentina, and many other countries when a government simply runs out of money and their ability to borrow. And the only thing left is either to default or to hyperinflate through devaluation or super austerity measures. I mean, they can try to bring it back under, but as we've seen how very popular those are in Greece right now, because when suddenly being told they have to pay for all of the goodies they had, people get very, very upset. So that's a hard thing to sell politically. But if you look at the debates, either on the Republican or Democratic side, there's almost no discussion of dealing with the deficit or budget. It's just new goodies. On the Republican side, occasionally you'll hear it pop up, but not very often, and it doesn't attract much attention. But listen to what some of the rhetoric is.
150 years ago, incredibly brave Americans said, you know what? Working class kids, low income kids, should not have to work in factories or on the farms. Like rich kids, they deserve to get a free education. And that free education of extraordinary accomplishment was from first grade to 12th grade. The world has changed. This is 2016. In many ways, a college degree today is equivalent to what a high school degree was 50, 60 years ago. So yeah, I do believe that when we talk about public education in America today, in a rapidly changing world, we should have free tuition at public colleges and universities. That should be a right of all Americans, regardless of the income of their families.
Okay, of course, how are we going to pay for that? And the answer is to tax Wall Street. Ironically, there's a contradiction in there, too, in what Senator Sanders just said, simply because of the fact that the quality of education has deteriorated under free education, which is why college has now moved down to the level of where high school would have been at one point. So he's almost defeating himself, but I don't think people catch on to that. I'm not sure he realizes that. But the bottom question is, where are you going to pay for this? And when government got involved in education, that's when you began to see its decline, because not only will it give you money to provide the freedom, but then it's going to start determining what you will teach, what you can say. You can see all of this following right behind it. And that never seems to come up in the elections. Now, I mean, the cost is just one thing on one side.
The best analysis that I've seen based on Senator Sanders' plans is that it would probably increase the size of the federal government by about 40%. But what is most concerning to me is that in looking at the plans, let's take health care, for example. Last week in a CNN town hall, the senator told a questioner that the questioner would spend about $500 in taxes to get about $5,000 in health care. every progressive economist who has analyzed that says that the numbers don't add up. And that's a promise that cannot be kept.
Obviously, that was former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And last but not least, questions about Donald Trump's budgeting.
Mr. Trump.
Yes.
You have made a lot of promises, and you have also, you're the only candidate who has said he would not touch entitlements. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget has estimated that your ideas would cost an additional $12 to $15 trillion over the next 10 years, and that we would have to have annual economic growth of anywhere from 7.7% to 9% annually to pay for them. Are you proposing more than you can actually deliver, at least not without big deficits?
First of all, when you say I'm the only candidate, if you listen to the Democrats, they want to do many things to Social Security. And I want to do them on its own merit. When you listen to them, what they want to do to Social Security, none of these folks are getting elected, okay, whether they can do it or not. I'm going to save Social Security. I'm going to bring jobs back from China. I'm going to bring jobs back from Mexico and from Japan, where they're all, every country throughout the world, now Vietnam, that's the new one. They are taking our jobs, they're taking our wealth, they're taking our base, and you and I have had this discussion. We're going to make our economy strong again. I'm lowering taxes. We have $2.5 trillion offshore. We have $2.5 trillion that I think is actually $5 trillion because the government has no idea when they say $2.5. They have no idea what they're doing or saying, as they've proven very well. We're going to bring that money back. You take a look at what happened just this week. China bought the Chicago Stock Exchange. China, a Chinese company. A carrier is moving to Mexico, air conditioning company. Not only the ones I talk about all the time, Nabisco and Ford, and they're all moving out. We have an economy that last quarter, GDP didn't grow. It was flat.
Sounds more like a prize fight, doesn't it?
Ding. Round two.
So, I mean, what are you going to do with all of that, this melange of stuff? Because it seems like the debt is dragging us into a crisis, and they're all debating somewhat peripheral issues, somewhat relevant, some not relevant.
Well, you know, John, there's another fact here that I think the media isn't talking about, which is the interest on the debt. Now, this is the one that basically we have covered this topic over and over, financial repression, which we'll cover again here. But interest on the debt will soon surpass defense and discretionary spending by the year 2021, according to the Congressional Budget Office. We've been spending a lot of time on this program discussing the concept of financial repression. I first raised this issue here on the program back in 2010. Now, for you listeners out there, the purpose of financial repression is to inflate away the debt and keep interest rates suppressed. What have you experienced the last 8 years? And now we're talking about in the next downturn, instead of zero rates, we could be talking about negative interest rates if you take a look at debt in Europe or, let's say, in Japan. And so who benefits from that? The government. And let me give you an example of what I mean and how this works to the advantage of government and to the detriment of its citizens, especially seniors and savers. Now, this is going to shock you. In 2008, the national debt was $10 trillion and some change. The interest the government had to pay on that $10 trillion of debt was $451 billion. In 2014, now when I say 2014, I'm talking about the government's fiscal year, which ends in September. The annual numbers are always different because you have three additional months. But in 2014, the national debt had risen to $17,824,000,000, but the interest expense to the government had fallen by $20 billion to $431 billion. The government's fiscal year ended September 2015. The national debt was $18,150,000,000. The interest on the national debt had fallen to $402 billion. Currently, on this day that we're doing this show, the national debt is over $19 trillion, and it'll be the budget deficit that ends the government's fiscal year in September. The budget deficit is expected to rise to $650 billion, and by the time Barack Obama leaves office in January, the debt will be at $20 trillion. So since 2008, we have added $8 trillion in debt, and interest expense has fallen by $49 billion. That, my friends, is what we call financial repression at work.
Okay, now here in my mind, this is the question that I have. You have all this debt. What happens down the road if interest rates rise? Obviously, we'll be at $20 trillion if we benchmark the swearing in of the new president. President Obama leaves office and President X is sworn in. What happens if the rates rise?
That's a major problem. And that's why I don't think we're going to see that, because, you know, the way we're looking at things, we could probably be in a recession by the end of this year or certainly in next year. But here's going back to financial repression. Today, the average interest rate on government debt is 2.06%. That's on marketable debt. On unmarketable debt, and we'll get into interest expense here in just a second to explain the way the government plays with these numbers. Non-marketable interest rate is 2.9%, and the average of all the government's debt is 2.34%. Clearly, the biggest winner here is government. Now, let me explain something. This is good news and bad news. Of all that $20 trillion of debt, 60% is owned in the free markets, meaning you and I could own some of that, a bond fund can own it, foreigners own it. The other 40% of the national debt is debt that's owed to itself. It's loans that the government has taken from Social Security. They've spent the surplus, and then they just issue IOUs. So only 60% of that 20 trillion, which is, you know, it'll be 12 trillion, is owned by foreigners and in the public marketplace. So when you hear the figure of $400 billion in interest, remember 60% of that only goes to the public and foreigners. The other 40% is IOUs that keep accumulating to itself. In other words, money that's owned to different government programs. So it's a little bit of obfuscation of how much debt and how much the government is really paying to run things. And it's something that began with the Johnson administration, and it's continued with every administration since.
Jim, but I'm going to bring this back to my question. You know, the government's only paying, what, 2% or something like that? What happens if the percentage points just goes up by what seems to be small, 1% or 2%? That really has big impacts.
Well, you know, we got $20 trillion in debt. The government is paying on average 2.06%. And plain and simple, John, every 1% increase in interest rates increases interest expense by $200 billion. If we were to go back to 5% interest rates, which were the norm for, let's say, federal funds rate, that would increase interest on the debt by $1 trillion to $1 trillion a year. We're spending about $400 billion now. That would be an additional $600 billion in interest on the debt. But the good thing with financial repression, we're a ways away from that. And as the U.S. approaches a recession, which I believe will happen next year, you are more likely to see lower interest rates and more quantitative easing. And if that doesn't work, to be followed by negative interest rates like we see today in Europe and Japan. That was a topic we covered on last week's program when it was raised in Janet Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill. Negative interest rates are probably coming here to the U.S. in the next recession. Let's put it this way. The Fed has very little room to maneuver here to raise rates. I mean, look how long it took them to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. It took them a whole year. And even now, they're questioning whether that was the right thing to do. So they've made a major policy error here that they need to correct soon, or there will be odds of a recession taking place this year.
And if we boil this all down to this year's election, we've almost got two extreme points of view right here. View on one side wants more spending, higher taxes. The other side seems to want the opposite. Although, again, I'm going to say, Jim, there's very little discussion of how we're going to, A, stop the deficit, and B, pay down the debt. That seems to be floating off the table. And there's very little common ground between these two points of view. Let's face it, it's going to be more a clear distinction when we have two candidates, Democrat and Republican, running against each other. But it's not surprising because of all of this, the financial markets are having a rough year. You know, if it isn't oil and stocks, it's politicians and stocks, because everything seems uncertain. So there's no planable future here.
Well, let's put it this way. The reason that you're not hearing the media talk about this, the reason you're not hearing politicians talk about it, because, I mean, it's like you go to your doctor. Let's say you're overweight, you've got high cholesterol, you're having problems health-wise, and the doctor says, hey, look, I'm sorry. Yeah, I could give you a pill, but you need to, one, start exercising. Two, you need to lose weight. You need to change your diet. You need to start eating healthy, and you need to de-stress and do all these things that, you know, hey, doc, can you just give me a pill? You know, and that's what happens. And so that's what politicians are out doing right now. They're offering voters a pill. Hey, if you elect me, you can get a whole bunch of free stuff. And guess what? You're not going to have to pay for it. We'll make somebody else pay for it. It'll be free. That's what sells in an election year. I don't care if it's rebuilding the military defense or it's free college and free medical. The problem is the common ground the next president faces will be a physical reality of the national debt. There are going to be some tough decisions to make, and there is going to be entitlement reforms. It'll either be done proactively or it will be forced by the markets on government, just as what you saw happen in Greece during their crisis or other European countries on the periphery in Europe. There's also going to have to be incentives to make the economy grow. Higher taxes, folks, and more regulation will turn a recession into a depression, as it did in 1937 when the government raised tax rates to 90%, just like Sanders wants to do, and the Fed raised interest rates, the result, through the markets, back into a bear market. Markets plunged, and the economy was back into a depression. And that's why this election is a turning point, at least in our view, in U.S. history, just as 1980 was. The elections turned this country around. We tamed inflation, and there were a lot of things that happened that went very well, and the economy prospered. As of this moment, John, I don't see any candidate on either side doing that, at least those candidates who were in the lead. I really don't like what I see right now, but, you know, that can change as we get closer to the election, when the candidates on both parties will have a nominee. And when traditionally, as you get closer to the election, they move more towards the center and say, okay, I said that to get the nomination, but here's what I really think I can do if you elect me. And they'll have their platform, which will be unveiled at the party convention. But the media is doing a poor job deliberating, concentrating on irrelevant. And well, Bernie said this about Hillary. Hillary said this about Bernie. Doing the same with the Republicans. They're obfuscating the real issues and focusing really on trivia and irrelevant. The result could lead to extreme outcomes.
Well, and while we're waiting for all of the extreme outcomes, Jim, maybe some lesser extreme things we're looking forward to over the next couple of weeks.
Well, this is related to topics that we covered in the big picture and also, you know, a future election. And this relates to what the Fed may do. And that's watch the economic numbers. The jobs numbers for January were weaker than expected. The economy slowed down in the fourth quarter, less than 2%. And so watch the economic numbers, because that's going to tell you if the futures market has this right, which says that Fed will probably not raise interest rates. If they do, probably to the fall. So watch the economic numbers. In a couple weeks, we will have the jobs numbers for the month of February. Watch the ISM numbers on manufacturing and service. Manufacturing is in a recession. Watch the service sector, because that is starting to weaken. If that goes below 50, that really is not good news for the incumbent party heading into the elections this fall. So we'll be focusing on the economic numbers, because that will determine a lot. And of course, in March, we'll have a FOMC meeting, and that will be the Fed's first revision to its forecast on growth, what it might do in 2016. And that will be coming up in March. But we're still working our way through the earnings season. And just as we talked about covering the topic of dividends, a lot of companies were basically saying, hey, things are not looking that spiffy for the first quarter as well. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.